Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
I believe united we stand, and we have common ground to find, and we're going to find it. We're not even going to use it.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And this is a power outage delayed version of Rewind. But first, wish I was there. Governor Evers signs a bill that hopefully will give us more sign language interpreters. And it also allowed Representative Jonathan Brostoff to get a haircut. I talked to individuals with who work with human trafficking in Milwaukee. One of them talks about why some women are so prone to being trafficked. And Craig Thompson talks about the infusion of cash means 200 state highway projects can go forth. Wish I was there.
From classroom to doctor's visits to courtrooms, members of the deaf and hard of hearing community rely on interpreters to communicate effectively and accurately. That's why I am incredibly proud to be signing AB 250 here today.
Every single person that you ever will meet in your entire life has a vulnerability. A trafficker is going to recognize that vulnerability and meet that vulnerability and then exceed it in the wrong ways in order to manipulate them into being trafficked.
A downtown Milwaukee office worker, not directly related to the DNC convention, should she or he take July 13th through 16th off?
We want to do everything that we need to do with local law enforcement and the Secret Service to have a very clear understanding of what the security perimeter is going to be like, what the impact is going to be like to people who live and work downtown. We're aiming to get that done so that we can have that conversation in the early part of next year with people.
The budget that was passed had $320 million for our state highway rehabilitation program, and we'll be able to begin getting out there and move forward more than 200 projects that would not have been able to move forward all across the state and every region of the state to fix those state roads.
At a time where we have a huge disparity between what the richest people in our state make versus what those who are suffering the most and are struggling under minimum wage with no benefits are making, I feel like the existence of unions, the existence of the ability to create a union, to petition for that, is something that closes that gap.
Most of us are very familiar with the concept of Teladoc or MD Live or the other services where you can get your sinus infection or your pink eye treated from the comfort of your home on your iPhone. So by removing the low acuity things from the provider's calendar, those office visits, and treating them in a faster, more convenient way at a lower price point, we free up space for higher acuity patients who really need to come in and, as I like to say, be poked or prodded by the doctor because they need to have a physical assessment.
Do you expect a new movie to be made, Mr. Walker Goes to Washington? There was an announcement last week. Scott Walker said he will be president of the Young America's Foundation starting full-time in 2021. You and I saw the news reports. The current retiring member, basic salary of more than $700K plus an additional benefits, more than $300. It sounds like a living wage. This means that Scott Walker will not be running for either governor or U.S. Senate in 2022. He and his wife, Tanette, will buy a Washington-area home but maintain a Wisconsin residence. You surprised by that announcement?
Yes and no. I mean, on the part where there's some surprise that Scott Walker is kind of like a political shark. He's always been swimming the waters, base his entire adult life in public office. So this is a pause on that. The question becomes, what is the foundation from doing this job to run for office again? Because we all kind of figure that Scott Walker is in his mid-50s. He has plenty of time to run for office down the line. How do you transition from this to running for office again? And talk to some folks. Some of the ideas I heard was that, look, this is a connection to Ronald Reagan, who was Scott Walker's political mentor, hero, whatever word you want to use. Two, it's a chance to talk to young people. Walker was not happy to see the drop-off of the Republican Party in the last couple exit polls. Mm-hmm. He did okay with young people in the 14 race. There's a chance to reconnect with them, so there's a chance to have access to young conservative leaders. So there's a way to create a connection for that kind of jumping off point down the road. What doesn't surprise me is that Scott Walker is going to get paid. Walker, if you look since leaving office, he's been doing the speaking tour, some other small things, But he's been in public office his almost his entire life. He's got a pretty good pension coming, I'm pretty positive. But if you look at his last disclosure statement he filed as governor, he still had serious debt for
credit card
loans.
Debt and student loan debt.
So it's a chance to take care of all that financially, you would assume.
Right. And Mr. Walker said, we have the truth on our side, but we must find new ways to get that message out to the next generation. And the Democratic Party chairman, Mr. Wickler, said, he's a career politician who spent his entire adult life chasing higher office. We have no reason to believe that suddenly changed. I guess the question I want to go back to before we end this segment, he and his wife, Tanette, are going to maintain a Wisconsin residence. So is your read on that clearly keeping an or open
sure.
for
But he's
the
also said, in one of the, he did a couple interviews after the announcement, he said 2024, also off the table, so it's a four-year commitment.
That's true, he's
signed. So take it through 2025. So there's that to watch. And, you know, the Democratic pushback has been like, look, there's a guy who cut UW system, who tried to remove the Wisconsin idea from the budget from state statute. They always said it was a drafting error. So they have a great track record with universities, but here he's going to work with basically a university crowd.
But he's Mr. Act 10.
Mm-hmm. And so. He also is going to now be on the Woodrow Wilson Board for Research. Got an appointment from President Trump last week.
Right, and that is for a six-year term. The Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars run through the Smithsonian.
Again, the pushback has been this guy doesn't actually have a great track record in academia when it comes to like supporting research and those kinds of things. But, you know, it's a pick for the president to put somebody who's from a conservative ideology on that board.
I still think it might make a decent movie, Mr. Walker Goes to Washington. Okay. I had the opportunity last week to interview the DNR secretary designate. He hasn't been confirmed yet, Preston Cole. JR, he made an interesting point. 1.7 million residents of Wisconsin rely on private wells. They rely on 800,000 private wells. I didn't know this, but I asked him, how often are those private wells tested? They're only tested about 10%. Mm-hmm. So, and he said every private well should be tested annually, and when we do get test results, we don't like what we're finding. He's calling for a new partnership between officials and well owners to help pay for the cost of testing, which can run hundreds of dollars, although under some circumstances, I think if you drop off your water on the east side where you and I both live at the state lab, you can get it tested for free. The Secretary Cole said, you want to know what's in your water. You have to know what's in your water. There's a lot at stake in regard to public health. This is part of the debate over the year of clean water, isn't it?
Oh, that's why I talked about wells, southwestern Wisconsin. A lot of stuff found in those wells that were tested.
42% of some of those
part
wells
of what
tested.
Prompted the Speaker's task force on groundwater.
Clean water.
So it's a theme, and it kind of cuts across party lines and across regional lines. You have lead laterals in Milwaukee. You have the private wells in southwestern Wisconsin. You have issues with CAFOs up in northeastern Wisconsin,
yes.
The Kewaunee County area,
yes.
Concerns about what's going on in the drinking water up there. So, yeah, it's a statewide issue at this point, and they want to show they're doing something about it.
And talk about CAFOs. He said in the course of our interview, which is available at wisci.org, that between 60 and 70% of CAFOs over the last 8 years went into just three counties, northeast Wisconsin. And he also said 77,000 Milwaukee lateral lines still. There's a question whether how much damage they're doing because they are lined with lead. So it's a huge issue. Now let's hear segments of my interview with Mr. Cole. Are you afraid at the level of groundwater contamination that we're now finding in Wisconsin?
We're concerned. There is no question there is a huge amount of concerns. My hope is that the legislature follows the lead of this governor and continues to make investments in our public drinking water and private drinking water services and systems.
Let's say I rely on a private well for my family's water, and I listen to this show and I get it tested and I don't like the results. What should I do next, sir?
Your next stop is to your public health official, whether that's in the county or your local jurisdiction. That begins the process to design a path forward.
What can one state, Wisconsin, do on climate change, sir?
Lead.
Lead?
Be the example for other states around designing and adaption to climate change. This economy is too important not to pay attention. So what do? We lead.
You guys at WisPolitics reported last week, the final numbers are in. Mm-hmm. How much the candidates for the state Supreme Court race in April spent? Judge Lisa Neubauer, because he's on the Court of Appeals, spent $2 million when you include both this year and last year. Justice-elect Brian Hagedorn, $1.68 million. So that's a total of $3.69. But then when you go back to the Democracy Campaign totals for third-party spending, $4.3 million, $2.7 million on behalf of Judge Neubauer, and $1.6 million on behalf of Judge, now Justice-elect Brian Hagedorn. This is a record. How big of a record?
Top 2008 when Michael Gibbon beat then Justice Louis Butler. I can't remember, it's like $1 million more, somewhere in that neck of the woods. What's interesting to me is that, one, you had the losing candidate, Judge Neubauer, have an advantage financially both in what she raised compared to Brian Hagedorn and what independent groups spent on her behalf. But when you look at the numbers, we went and looked from the last reporting period in March through the end of June, he outraised her. And that's an indicator of the enthusiasm that picked up for the Hagedorn campaign toward the end and pushed him over the top. A lot of what, you know, Neubauer's advantage was is she gave herself a $250,000 loan in June of 2018 that gave her a big financial head start. It's reflected in the final numbers where she outraised him or by about $300,000-some. So a lot of that was self-financing. But again, the enthusiasm that came in the end, my guess is that, yeah, the outside group spent more for her than him, but at the end it was a lot closer independent spending the last week. That's when you saw the RSLC, the Republican State Leadership Committee, come in with this Fair Justice Initiative group that it calls itself. It's dropped $1.2 million the final week doing things, and it really kind of evened the playing field and helped him win that race.
It's so intriguing, though. Judge Neubauer, $2 million with her own campaign.
First candidate to raise and spend $2 million ever for the Supreme Court in Wisconsin.
Wow. $2.7 million by third-party groups backing her. And then Justice-elect Hagedorn, $3.2 million. That's a gap, obviously, $1.5 million.
Yeah.
So, talk about, do you think this election in April was the one that we saw the most involvement by the two parties, Democrats for Neubauer, Republicans for Hagedorn?
Political parties, yes and no. Republican Party kept ramping up its game. But remember, I think we talked this in the spring, Hagedorn's campaign actually sent money to the state GOP. And now you can't earmark money for any purpose in Wisconsin under campaign finance laws. So the party then spent money to help Hagedorn. But actually, the state party was the biggest donor to, in last year's race, the sort of candidate, Judge Skrenik. This time you saw a little more of an increase from the Democratic Party helping out Neubauer. But what we've seen so far in these races is that the Democratic Party has been kind of at arm's length when it comes to Supreme Court races. Either the candidates or the party don't really want to get that entangled. But in my interviews with both Ben Wickler, who won the chair race, other candidates for the race, they talked about they have to get more involved as a party with Supreme Court races because it's kind of a necessity. Republicans have shown no qualms about getting involved in the judicial campaign. Yes, we've heard complaints about the court being politicized, but it's been that way for a long time. So why fight without all weapons available to you at this point?
And just a P.S., now Justice-elect Hagedorn has announced that he will be formally joining the court, I think it's August 14th, correct?
The investiture is August 14th, yes.
August 14th. Okay. You guys at WisPolitics also went deep inside some numbers, and I'm just fascinated by how much our eight U.S. House members are sitting on in cash. They're coming off elections, with the exception, I think, the only one who wasn't challenged was Kind. Well, here's what strikes me. When you look at what Kind has in his district, the Democrat who's been there decades, he has 45 times, cash on hand, $2.6 million, 45 times what Congresswoman Gwen Moore, Milwaukee, Democratic 4th District, has, $58,000. Now, explain to me why Kind has 2.6, Duffy 2.2, Mike Gallagher 1.4. So those three, and then you have this big disparity dropping down to Congresswoman Gwen Moore.
Gwen Moore's district is not competitive. Who's second lowest on the list?
Jim Sensenbrenner, $369,000.
Not competitive. Who's third lowest on the list?
Glenn Grothman.
His district, not really competitive. Now go up. Ron Kind is number one target next fall. Now, I say that Republicans talk about targeting Ron Kind
every cycle.
But they're targeting him because President Trump won Kind's district 2016. Here's a problem. We sit here late July. There's no announced candidate to challenge Ron Kind. It's kind of hard to buy into the idea of they're willing to go after him without a candidate who's raising money and preparing to take him on because he has so much cash on hand. Sean Duffy, he's mentioned a possible statewide candidate. So part of the reason why he has so much money is he knocked off an incumbent Democrat back in 2010. Well, actually, I should say, Dave Obey retired in 2010, which Duffy's still loved by Republicans for pushing out Dave Obey in their minds. But Duffy had a challenge in 10 to win that seat, 12 he was challenged. Now he's building resources because he might run statewide someday. Mike Gallagher, young, aggressive, thought of to have a bright future ahead of him. He actually has an announced candidate so far, Amanda Stuck, state representative from Appleton. That district is not really that competitive. It's a serious GOP lean. But Gallagher, again, mentioned for a statewide office someday. So that's part of why they've raised so much, is to build toward the future. And then you have Brian Stile, who's a freshman, and the first reelect is always the toughest. He is banking money to try and ward off any challengers in a Republican-leaning district.
Well, I want to use the governor's term, and I want to, is it fair to connect these dots? Last week, when there was a vote, when there was a resolution up to begin the impeachment process, mm-hmm. who was the only Democrat to vote against that?
Ron Kind. Ron Kind is representing a district that is not Milwaukee or Madison. It is western Wisconsin. It is more blue-collar. You have La Crosse in that district. I can't remember where other municipalities, but you're not talking a major urban area. You're talking more rural Dems, and he reflects them. I mean, he avoids going to he went to the Democratic National Convention in 2016 and got shouted down by pro-labor activists because he's a free trade Democrat. But that's what fits his district. You know, that's just who Kind is.
Well, and he didn't go to this year's state convention.
Yeah, he was somewhere else. He went 18 years there for that.
Okay. Well, direct link in his vote against to not begin the impeachment process and the fact that he's always targeted?
Maybe, but it's also a reflection of his district. I mean, think about it. There were 95 Democrats out of 240-some, 250-some.
Yeah.
It's still not a majority of the entire caucus that wants to move forward impeachment. So he's kind of where mainstream Democrats are right now.
Okay, and let's talk about, there was also a vote last week on a resolution that would condemn the president's remarks, and pretty predictable, R5 GOP voted against that, and R3 Dems voted for that, correct?
Yeah, and Republicans, look, Paul Ryan learned this lesson the hard way. You don't get much reward from challenging President Trump if you're a Republican. You just don't. Even when there are times that they want to, when they would publicly find what the president's done to be distasteful, they're not piping up because the base has moved from the Paul Ryan party to the Donald Trump party. And so if you cross Donald Trump, you get shouted down. Ryan said this, that, you know, Reagan beat Ford, now Trump has beaten Reagan or something like that. The party has moved. It's just a reality where things are for them.
Well, and Sean Duffy drew some national headlines for his what the Democrats and liberal groups called a rant on the U.S. House floor, defending the president's comments against the Squad. Mike Gallagher also drew national notice for attacking the president's comments. So yeah, it's just
he
pretty
just
interesting.
He just said that everybody should calm down and drop the rhetoric.
Well, I thought that's what Senator Johnson said.
But none of them have really gone out of their way to condemn the president. I mean, look at their comments closely. Yes, they will be critical of this is not the kind of language we need, or everybody needs, you know, I find this just, Ron Johnson said on a national network, you see CNN over the weekend, I don't agree. That's the harshest thing he said about the president tweeted, okay? Republicans are not challenging him one-on-one because they just don't see an upside to it. And, Democrats argue because they're afraid of him, and maybe that's the case, but you're not seeing Republicans really take the president to task. What happens when they do? Justin Amash in Michigan.
He's no longer. The party?
Yeah.
One of four that voted for the
Mitt Romney.
To begin the impeachment.
He does it every once in a while. He gets beat up on social media for it. You're not seeing a real uprise of Republicans take on this president.
Okay. I'm calling it unfinished business. Let's return once more to the issue of redistricting, JR. In the wake of the June Supreme Court ruling that said drawing fair district lines is the job of states, legislatures, governors, and state Supreme Courts, the ruling prompted a new push last week for the Evers plan to have nonpartisan legislative agency draw maps. GOP leaders removed Evers' plan from 2019-21 budget. Before we hear from Senator Hansen And Speaker, Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald, let's talk about some of the comments from Robin Vining. She said, I am not here to draw maps to protect my job. I'm here to draw maps to protect the will of the people with Fair Maps legislation. Before we hear from those other leaders, let's hear from Speaker Voss. Rather than handing over our constitutional duty to an unelected, unaccountable board of bureaucrats appointed by politicians, redistricting should continue to be the responsibility of the legislature and the governor. Here's what strikes me. In the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court decision, it said it is squarely the job of legislators, governors, and state Supreme Courts to rule on this. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court threw out a plan drawn by their legislature. Mm-hmm.
Off the state constitution, not the U.S. Constitution, so why that ruling stood in light of what happened to the Supreme Court.
Right. But doesn't this make a huge issue? I think we've touched on this before in the next Supreme Court election.
Yes and no, because it doesn't matter who wins next spring. It's going to still be a conservative majority. So like we've talked about, the question I have about redistricting in 2021 is which court draws the map. Will it be the state Supreme Court or will it be a federal court? Probably in Madison. We'll see. I'm going to guess that attorneys are going to race to the courts on both sides to try and make their case of why that court should hear it. But I just don't see a way that this is going to be done as a bill.
But when the governor says this is a litmus test for candidates in the November 2020 election for the legislature, whether they support my redistricting plan in light of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling, does that have any potential to be a real issue with voters?
Likely not. It is very much a popular position to be in favor of a nonpartisan redistricting process. People like the way it sounds. But if you think about what really motivates voters to go to the polls, show me one candidate, just one, who's lost on the issue of redistricting.
I don't think I can.
So, I mean, think about it. Much like the Medicaid debate. I mean, like Democrats have hammered Republicans over the Medicaid issue for how many years? How many times have a Republican lawmaker lost a legislative seat over Medicaid expansion? Now, it was a big issue for Governor Walker and AG Brad Schimmel. But I'm talking about, I don't know, it's a motivating issue for people. And the thing with Medicaid with Walker and Schimmel was not just because they refused expansion, they were part of a lawsuit to overturn the Affordable Care Act. That's a different ballgame, too.
But when the Marquette polls show 70% support mm-hmm. for drawing maps in a new way, 74% for MA, then there's a disconnect when voters actually go to the polls.
No, I'm just saying it's not a motivating issue. Like, what drives people to vote? A lot of times it's their job.
Healthcare. Opportunities for my kids.
Yeah.
What's tuition's going to cost, either at our tech schools or the UW system or at a private college and universities? Okay.
So when think about it, with healthcare, I mean, like, it's a kind of an interesting animal of, like, do you have insurance for your employer? It's a different ballgame for you than if you don't, if you're on the exchanges, than if you're on a public program. It's a much different dynamic for all those groups of people.
Yeah. Okay, now let's hear from Senator Dave Hansen, the Democrat, and the answer on should we begin to hold hearings on bills that would create the Governor Evers way to have a legislative agency draft maps, and the response from Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald. Please.
Do the right thing. Pass a nonpartisan redistricting law that will give the people of the state the type of elections they deserve. Our legislation, Senate Bill 288 and Assembly Bill 303, do just that. We now have three Republican senators on our bill, Representative Novak, Representative Trano, and just recently up in Door County, Representative Kitchens.
Would there be any support amongst yourself or the Republican caucus to take it up in hearing or consider any legislation put forth, sir?
No, I mean, I think we'll fall back into the plan of the census will be completed and redistricting will fall in 2021. And it'll be a different legislature, obviously, because you'll have another set of elections. So we can have that discussion at that point in time.
That was a pretty definitive statement from Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald. Not going to happen. You don't need to read my lips. Not going to happen. Right. Okay. Your stock picks. Rising.
Pat Teston, so a freshman Republican from
Stevens Point.
Senator. He is raising money like a target. He pulled in $93,000 in the first 6 months of the year. He had more than $200,000 in the bank. I mean, this is a district that is pretty much Trump country anymore. He knocked off a Democrat in 2016. So you look at the maps from 18, Walker won the district, so did Baldwin. This guy's preparing for them to come after him. Look at Patty Schottner over in Somerset, Western mm-hmm. Wisconsin. Won
District 10.
A January 2018 special election, the first time of a blue wave in Wisconsin that year. She had about $30,000 in the bank. She's not really fundraising the level that Teston is. Teston is putting himself in a position to fend off any challenge. It's also an indicator of how Democrats are kind of struggling overall fundraising, like Senate races. The question really is for 2020 is not, can Democrats win back the majority or even really close the gap dramatically? It's can they avoid a two-thirds majority for Republicans, becomes a veto-proof majority.
Do the Democrats have a candidate against Teston?
Not yet. Not announced.
They'd like Shanklin to run.
Possibly. I've heard that name mentioned before. But for you look at the maps, and Republicans have really maximized their performance in a lot of ways. In the Senate, Schottner's an obvious target. Dave Hansen up in Green Bay has held a seat that's been won by Trump and Republicans before. He survives no matter what. Dave has a certain populism that's popular in that district. He hasn't said he's going to run again. If you can win those two seats, right, now you only need one more to get to 22 in the Senate. Jennifer Schilling won by less than 100 votes in 2016. Now, different dynamic this time around. Ron Kind should have an opponent. They're not going to be caught napping after what happened in 2016. So that race probably changes somewhat. You can't say she's safe. Even though in 2018, Tony Evers did about normal in that deal, like around 10 points in her Senate district. In the Assembly then, you go, okay, can they get to 66 there? Maybe. It's a tough row to hold, but maybe. And then if they get to the veto-proof majority, then Evers' life's changed dramatically if that happens. I'm not predicting it will.
Right.
But that's what you got to guard against if you're a Democrat next year.
Right. And we'll get into some veto potentials in this Friday's Rewind Mixed.
So, Tony Evers, so the governor is not a political animal. He is, in many ways, the anti-Scott Walker, okay? He's a guy who was an educator, became state superintendent, now he's governor. If he wants to really get his legs and improve his holding on the powers in the governor's office, he should probably be more political, people tell me. First, look at his fundraising. His fundraising was okay. He raised $650-some thousand first half of the year. Like a lot of money, right? Let's break down what Evers has to do in 2022. He probably has to raise $20 million plus. Okay?
$20 million.
Walker raised $35 million. And no, Walker is the undisputed heavyweight of fundraising in Wisconsin for a state candidate. I mean, Tammy Baldwin, can't forget her for federal candidates,
right,
but
right.
State candidates. Walker to $35 million. Let's say $20 million for Evers. Let's say the last year of that race, he has to raise half of it. You need to average $3 million a year if you're Tony Evers to be prepared for 2022. He's on that pace. Then let's talk about the Chuck Kuala criticism. So we have that show, Wiss Opinion,
right.
The Insiders. It's a thing that we do on the web with our sister publication, Wiss Opinion. Kuala ripped into former Senate Majority Leader, Democrat. Wife is on the Evers staff as deputy chief, one of the deputy chiefs of staff. Ripped the governor as basically getting his butt whooped
in the
budget process.
Yes.
Saying he failed, he should have fought tooth and nail this thing.
Should have vetoed the whole budget.
There are a couple things about this. Number one, what's Chuck's motivation? I mean, you have a spouse on staff and you're basically criticizing on the staff and the budget. Like, what's that all about? Number two, was something he wanted the budget he didn't get. You know, Chuck has been around for a long time. Don't forget, left office after being charged with several felonies in the caucus scandal.
Which means he could be applying for a pardon. Go ahead.
Finally, does his criticism make sense? And this is the pushback I got. Yeah, there are some people who argue that Evers should have vetoed the budget. But there's a giant hole in Chuck's logic. Chuck, as people told me last week, arguing old school. Yeah, 20 years ago, there were swing seat Republicans who you could have pressured on a budget standoff, an impasse that come September, October, they'd have felt the heat. Chuck's argument was, those guys are on the ballot in 2020. Evers is not. He has time to recover. But there are no swing seat Republicans left to feel the heat and buckle to the pressure. They're actually more likely the Republicans who weren't as a badge of honor not doing a budget. So there are some questions about that criticism if he was off base or not. But the bottom line of Evers is, he's a really nice guy. You know, he's not somebody who would want to be governor for years, unlike Scott Walker or Jim Doyle. But he needs to be a little bit more of a political animal, a little more of that edge to him to try and sway how things are going if he wants to be successful going forward. It's just the nature of the beast.
Okay. You got less than a minute for your falling.
UAB tuition funds. These are like the funds left over from tuition after you pay off your bills.
Yeah.
The so-called slush funds, Republicans ripped them on about 6 years ago. Those balances have dropped from like $550 million and change around $257 million, so by more than half. Actually, Stevens Point, July 1st, had a zero balance, I think, had a part of their corrective actions. You want to have a reserve if you're an institution like this. But it just shows that with the tuition freeze, what's been going on, these balances have been going down.
Okay. And programming notes this week, we have clean water. We have joint finance meeting tomorrow. And you'll be gone Friday.
Yes.
So Patrick Marley of the Journal Sentinel will be sitting in. And our guest for the first half of that show will be State Transportation Secretary Craig Thompson. Exactly how are they going to spend all this additional money that was part of the state budget? I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for the week of July 15th.